give off their expertise in the form of maybe photographers, graphic designers, architects, etc. We have an advisory board who guides us on various matters and are experts in their respective fields, but whose hearts are connected with the cause. And of course, we have volunteers who, you know, regularly go into the classrooms and work one-on-one with the children. But I do believe all of these initiatives, great as they are, have to be coupled with funding for access to these kind of areas of support independently.
They are all around us, but you can't see them because they are shut in. One of the new projects we are starting on is a campaign to try and make the disabled more visible. How do we plan to do that? We plan to do that by campaigning to increase accessibility, to remove barriers, and we're doing that by using some innovative technology.
Hello and welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. I'm your host, Gaurav Chaudhary. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, investors, and businesses, and professionals, and of course, philanthropists who are disruptors, yet not in your face. Their disruptions have consistently delivered on the purpose their mission have embarked on. Their values are as strong as the mission. Unusual Suspects streams on earshot.in, spotify.com, Google Podcast, Apple Podcasts, moneycontrol.com, and a host of other streaming platforms. In this special episodes, Catalyzing Change, The Power of Family Philanthropy, as part of Unusual Suspects in collaboration with GivingPi, India's first family-focused philanthropy network, we'd be talking about the rapidly evolving philanthropic landscape and the paradigm shift that is underway. Philanthropists are increasingly leveraging technology, engaging in collaborative efforts, and exploring innovative financial models, besides placing a strong emphasis on equity and inclusion in their giving strategies. Together with families and philanthropists, we explore diverse giving approaches and evolving perspectives, aiming to inspire a new era of impactful philanthropy, especially in critical and underserved sectors. Despite existing laws, persons with disabilities often face mistreatment and are denied basic human dignity. There's a critical need for philanthropy to step up its efforts and invest with greater intentionality in the disability space in India. For this episode, I'm delighted to have Archana Chandra, board member and CEO, Jay Vakil Foundation, one of the largest NGOs serving individuals with intellectual disabilities. She's also a trustee of SRCC, which is building the largest hospital dedicated to children in the country. I also have Jacob Kurian, honorary secretary and trustee of the Association of People with Disability, a 63-year-old NGO which works to support people with disabilities in the areas of health, education, livelihood, and advocacy. Welcome to Unusual Suspects, Archana and Jacob. Delighted to have you here.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Archana, first to you. You know, your journey as a philanthropist and your dedication to improving the lives of individuals with intellectual disabilities is commendable, to say the least. Could you share what motivated you to dedicate your life to this cause and how your giving journey has evolved over time, Archana?
Sure, Gaurav. So my husband Amit and I have actually been giving a percentage of our income from the very first year of our marriage. And I think over the years, we've tried to increase the scale of this giving, both in terms of our wealth as well as time. And a big source of inspiration for us was actually Chuck Feeney's biography, The Billionaire Who Wasn't, which is actually a story of how he made his wealth by starting the duty-free stores and then gave it all away in a very active way where he was solving problems, building institutes, thereby transforming millions of lives in the process. Today, we also have a foundation for Amit and me, which is called the ATE Chandra Foundation. And this has helped actually give structure to our giving. It also helps us to focus on areas that we care deeply about, as well as maximize our returns. So that's with regard to the foundation. My journey at Jai Vakil actually happened quite by chance. I began my career by working at the Times of India Group and then moved on to work at a US-based database company. And I think my life followed a pretty standard course till up until 2000, when a series of events happened in my personal space. And that, you know, got me looking for answers to why me, and then what really is the purpose of my life, et cetera. And that's how I think I began my journey in the social sector. I started with the Akansha Foundation that works for education of children in municipal schools. Over there, I did some fundraising, marketing, and even ran HR for a bit. Another chance encounter led me to Jai Vakil. And it all began one morning when I stepped foot on the campus, brought here by a very dear friend, Anita Pandol. And I have to admit that initially I was very skeptical about coming here because I knew nothing about intellectual disability. I visited the campus. I met the children who inhabited a world that was so removed from mine. They had huge struggles, but they had the most infectious smiles and were genuinely happy. There was so much positive energy on the campus that my heart was engaged straight away. I went back and looked for data. I honestly struggled to find any data in this space, but what I did find said that 2% of our population have intellectual disability. That's 26 million or 1 in 50. And I was shocked because if the numbers were so large, then I couldn't remember the last time I had seen any of these people in any of the public spaces that I go to, theaters, malls, weddings, anywhere. They all seem to be kind of hidden away. And that's how my head got engaged and I began to volunteer. I was happy to give my time and whatever expertise I had to a space that is so underserved and desperately needed the spotlight on it. I've been fortunate to have worked very closely with Mrs. Shroff, who was part of the founding families for nearly six of my 15 years that I've been at Jai Vakil. And 11 years ago, when Mrs. Shroff passed, I took on the leadership role. Today, Jai Vakil is the oldest and largest not-for-profit in this space. Actually, this is our 80th year, so we've been around for longer than even India's independence. And we serve children and adults with intellectual disability. We have about 700 students from the ages of 3 to 50 across the three campuses. That's Mumbai, Devlali, and Talegaon. And our goal for all our children is inclusion. And we've divided that to be at a family, community, and society level. Our main areas of intervention are healthcare, education, and skill development, through which we aim to equip and empower our students as well as their families to lead more inclusive lives.
Thank you, Archana. Jacob, you know, your transition from a successful corporate career to serving as a trustee and honorary secretary at the Association of People with Disability, APD, is quite inspiring. Could you share what motivated you to shift your focus towards empowering people with disabilities and perhaps highlight your personal journey of giving in this space?
Let me first say that it's such a privilege to be with Archana and Amit and to have known Archana and Amit because their personal example is so inspiring. I started my career with a couple of decades in the Tata Group. The Tatas, as you know, are very well known for their philanthropic work. And it was one of the things that motivated me to join the Tata Administrative Service. But having joined the Tata Group as an employee, I discovered that there was very little engagement that we had in the philanthropic work. The trust did all the work and we generated maybe the profits that enabled the Tata Group to support the trust. I then had the opportunity to go to America, where I observed that volunteering and employee engagement could be done in a far more engaging manner. From the CEO down, people, even if it was only symbolic, participated in a lot of the activities and the giving challenges. So when we came back to India and I joined Titan, it was my hope that I would do something a little different. We did a couple of very innovative partnership programs with NGOs, but we were all busy with our line responsibilities. And by then the CSR law had come, CSR departments were formed, and then it quickly became something for CSR to do and not for us employees. So I always felt this was an opportunity area where we could bring greater capabilities, talents, and abilities. Archana mentioned what she could bring to Jai Vakil. Likewise, I felt that the sector would benefit from each of us bringing different capabilities to the cause. And I ran into APD quite by accident. The Association of People with Disability was one of the NGOs I was directed to when, in my investor avatar, we were looking to help a QSR company that we had invested in to find employees. And in Titan, we have a large and a very productive department manned by speech and hearing impaired people. That's always been a very productive and inspiring place to go and see. So when I said to the QSR company, why don't we look at persons with disability? They're more loyal, they're more dedicated, they're more grateful for the opportunities we give them. Everybody threw up their hands and said, are you mad? You know, there's fire, there's sharp objects, there's steam, there's all kinds of hazards. And why would you want to do this? And it brought a realization that people think of disability on the infrequent occasions they do as a monolith. Everybody has some stereotype in their minds that person with disability is completely helpless and just needs sympathy or charity. And what we were able to do with the QSR company and with APD as the partner was to identify jobs and map them to skills. It has now become much more common to do this. But at the time we did that, we were able to get somebody on a wheelchair, a cashiering position. We were able to get a speech and hearing person who was physically quite capable to do work in the back of the house, and so on and so forth. So that initiative won a national HRD award. I got exposure at an intimate level with a lot of these people with disability. And what struck me was that, you know, they are such an amazing example for all of us who come from relatively privileged backgrounds and don't suffer from any significant disabilities. They show such incredible courage. They're so optimistic in the face of such despair and such hopelessness. But they wake up every day and, you know, battle their way through life. So when I thought of leaving corporate life, and I was thinking about what to do, I chose to work in disability because disability is a cross-cutting problem. It doesn't discriminate the rich or the poor. Everybody is affected, can be affected. It doesn't discriminate on age, religion, caste, geography, region. And while the middle class and the upper class have access to medical and private help and assistance at home, for the poorest of the poor, a person with disability in the family, whether it's an elder or a young child or a working adult who, you know, has a work-related accident and is paralyzed, this devastates their family, okay? Completely collapses the family unit. And I thought this was an underserved and, as Archana put it, a completely invisible minority, which is not getting either time, attention, or money. And it was a big enough problem to try and break my post-retirement head on. That's how I came to this, Gaurav.
Very interesting and inspiring, Jacob, I should say. You know, a common question for both of you, particularly in the context of philanthropy in the disability space. What are some of the challenges that you have observed, and how have you navigated those challenges? Archana, first to you, and then Jacob. Archana.
Thanks, Gaurav. Jacob, you articulated it so well. And, you know, I'd like to kind of add to that, because I have found that even within the disability space, intellectual disability is the most invisible. Honestly, if, you know, just now I had said that we work with the visually impaired, everybody hearing this podcast will get a visual of a child with dark glasses and a white cane. So also for hearing impaired, you get a visual of a child wearing a hearing aid. And for cerebral palsy, you can visualize a child in a wheelchair. But I found that most often when we say that we work with children and adults with intellectual disability, the face in front of me has drawn a blank because there is no vision that comes to their mind that they can relate to. Even today, as we are talking, we're using the politically correct term of, you know, all these people having intellectual disability. But honestly, the colloquial word used to describe this condition is pagal, which has such a negative connotation to it. There's a stigma attached to this condition, as a result of which we often find that even families shy away from acknowledging this condition and do not seek the interventions in a timely manner. So I think the first and most important challenge, I would say, is just spreading awareness and educating people on what is intellectual disability. And I'm kind of narrowing down what I'm speaking to over here. And honestly, again, the truth is that even I didn't understand what really it meant, what was I to expect before I got to Jai Vakil, right? And I feel once people understand it, they will be less afraid and thereby more accepting, which will then eventually lead to the inclusion of these people in mainstream society. You know, like I mentioned earlier, when I was looking for data to support my understanding of how many people even have intellectual disability, I couldn't find any data, right? The census says 2% of our population has disabilities. So I was struggling to find data that I could work with. NIPID says it was 2%. It was only recently that, you know, DASRA actually partnered with the Bank of America to create this report called, I think, Count Me In. And which said that 2 to 3% of our population has intellectual disabilities. So I feel initiatives such as these, where organizations like ADASRA, supported with and partnered by, you know, Bank of America, create reports like this, will go a very long way in even ascertaining the size and magnitude of the issue that we are discussing. At Jai Vakil, we work with the entire spectrum of intellectual disability, which again is such a huge challenge. There are no benchmarks. Tracking of measurement of outcomes is tricky, as each child with disability is unique, needs specific interventions, and often progress is slow. So it's important that donors make the effort to really understand the space and agree to be partners in the long term. The second big challenge, which comes again from lack of awareness again, would be funding. So I took over the leadership role in 2013, and fundraising was one of our big challenges. Of course, it continues to be. But I was really hopeful because, again, like, you know, Jacob mentioned, in 2014, the CSR bill was passed. And I was like, oh, yay, you know, we're going to get some money our way. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, we used to start our pitch by saying we're a 69-year-old organization. We work with students and with intellectual disability. We do blah, 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 blah. And often the person on the other side would say, oh, you lovely human being, you great organization, you're doing amazing work. But unfortunately, we don't support intellectual disability. And this happened to us many, many times. And we used to always ask them at the end of, you know, the conversation, what are the areas that you do support? And they would most often say healthcare, education, and skill development. It took many such meetings for us for the penny to drop. And we learned how to change our pitch to say that, you know, we do education, healthcare, and skill development for our kids, and they just happen to be intellectually challenged. And that's how really we broke through our first donor, which was Credit Suisse, and started supporting us, which was a huge game changer. Because again, when organizations like this make the effort and time to understand the cause and support it, it helps the ecosystem to also consider you favorably. I'd like to give a shout out over here to actually HT Parikh Foundation, which does the most amazing job of recommending other donors to NGOs in the disability space. Within fundraising, it's one thing to raise money for OPEX, but the other is building a corpus. No one wants to give us money for trying new things. Everyone wants to fund proven programs. And I think in a space like ours, it's very important to try new things. Like I said, there are no benchmarks, there are no standard ways of doing things. So how do you try new innovative things, out of which all will not succeed, only some will? And we now have candid palms up conversations with all our donors and actually urge them to give a percentage of their funding towards corpus and not only program. In 2019 was actually Jaivakil's 75th year anniversary. And we envisioned a unique project, which we called Champions of Change, in order to raise funds for the Institute, as well as spread awareness and help in long-term sustainability. We are, you know, excited to share that we got 101 donors who pledged an amount to help us build this corpus. I think the third area that one struggles with is talent. The ask from the social sector is huge. The resources available to us are limited, and we always have to think different in terms of how to get work done, because most donors do not want to fund non-program costs. A big challenge is, of course, to access talent to be able to do what we want. And here, I think I'd like to just add that when I'm talking about philanthropy, I'm talking about not just giving money, but also time. So in 2013, when I took on the leadership role, we wanted to do so many things. Our bar was high, but we just didn't have the funds. And so we were forced to actually think of out-of-the-box ways to do things. And here we learned how to leverage the volunteering model. So Gaurav, at that time, our name used to be the Research Society for the Care, Treatment, and Training of Children in Need of Special Care. A mouthful that nobody understood. And they'd say, oh, so what do you do? And then when we said Jaivakil Foundation, they were like, oh yes, we've heard of them. And you know, if anyone agreed to give us money, that name wouldn't even fit on our check. So we actually changed our name. We called it the Jaivakil Foundation, but we needed somebody to help with branding, the logo, the color, the look and feel. And that's when we went to Shirin, who's a graphic designer, and she agreed to do one pro bono exercise or activity like this for us every year. Of course, many years later, Shirin continues to be with us and is on our advisory board. Similarly, we wanted to, you know, build an MIS system. Like you said, we need technology. We need to be able to look at and analyze data. But we didn't have the funds to build that system for ourselves. And so we partnered with Edelgive Foundation, which encourages their Edelweiss employees to volunteer their expertise. And that's how we built out our first MIS place. Even today at Jaivakil, we leverage or lean on the volunteering model very heavily. We have four areas that people volunteer with us. One is, of course, where they lead departments or initiatives as full-time volunteers. The second is where professionals come in to just give off their expertise in the form of maybe photographers, graphic designers, architects, etc. We have an advisory board who guides us on various matters and are experts in their respective fields, but whose hearts are connected with the cause. And of course, we have volunteers who, you know, regularly go into the classrooms and work one-on-one with the children. But I do believe all of these initiatives, great as they are, have to be coupled with funding for access to these kind of areas of support independently.
Great, Archana. Very, very inspiring. You know, Jacob, sorry to interrupt. You were speaking something, but I just wanted to touch upon one point to you, Jacob, also, because Archana raised a very important point on when the CSR law came. And, you know, it, at that time, everyone people like you who are working in this space thought that it's going to open up a whole host of easier access and opportunities to do a lot of philanthropy work through institutional funding. Did you have similar expectations, and do you think those expectations have actually not been met, Jacob?
So in our case, it's a mixed bag in the sense that the amount of funding that we have raised has significantly increased because, like Archana, we too figured out how to explain what we do in a manner that CSR teams can understand. But the nature of the CSR law, which is very much focused on a short-term commitment based on that 2% this thing, so at most 2 years or 3 years, makes for a very challenging operational environment for people like us who have teams in remote areas and work on intractable problems like climate, like disability. If somebody funds you for a year and says, okay, do something, make people better, it's really not possible to do that. You need a sustained intervention for 3 or 4 years to see the benefits of that happening. And as you know, in APD, we work across the life cycle of a person with disability. We start with identifying children in our early intervention program. We go house to house to find these children with developmental delays because the mothers are often illiterate and don't even know that their child is not meeting developmental milestones. We then try to get them to train the mothers to be the primary interventionists. And when the child starts to respond, we then try to get them into the education system, whether it's Anganwadis and then into government schools. Again, government schools are not equipped. They have to admit these kids, but there are no special teachers. The schools are not adapted. Toilets are not accessible. And there are a whole host of how do children get to school and back if you have a disability, so on and so forth. So what the CSR law does, and unfortunately, the CSR community is also evolving. They want quick numbers, large numbers. These are mindsets I'm very familiar with because all of us who come from a corporate background understand that more numbers is more important. Whereas impact and the magnitude of the impact, one child with disability being given the ability to go to a school or a young adult getting a chance to become economically independent by giving him a job. These are quantum changes at that level. But unfortunately, many CSR donors just look at this in a very short-term mindset. And unfortunately, having been on many boards and on CSR committees, I know that the time spent by the CSR committee is the shortest because of the various gatekeepers. The board of directors never get to really meet the NGOs they support. We are not allowed as an NGO to make a pitch. And so, you get arbitrary and ad hoc decisions because of changes that happen, say, in the corporate sector. So just yesterday, we had this distressing news that a donor of over 10 or 11 years standing had committed to a saturation approach that APD is uniquely able to bring to disability. Okay, we bring all our programs, whether it's early intervention, whether it's inclusive education, livelihoods, mental health, spinal cord injury rehab, policy and advocacy team to a particular district. And we try to identify everybody who is there and has been left behind and bring them both into the government social security net but also to start to bring all these interventions that we have to that community. Now, clearly, this takes a long time to set up. It takes time to catch, gather momentum, and therefore they had committed to a 3 to 5 year project duration with us. Now, what happened is they merged. Now, we have a large team who have relocated to be on the ground in that district. And yesterday, post the merger, it's a one-liner saying, sorry, our CSR charter has changed. We will no longer be supporting disability. Okay, now, I respect their right to decide their charter, but surely if you're in the middle of a program, I feel that one is owed at least the opportunity to find another donor, to give us a time to transition. So in many, many ways, we have no alternatives because APD was the beneficiary over the 65 years we've been around of a great mix of foundation money, which typically is very patient money, and also quite knowledgeable money about, the development sector, including many leading names, both in India and overseas. A lot of that money has now been difficult to get because of changes in the environment, and they have been substituted in our case with CSR money. But CSR money, unfortunately, has this catch to it. And we are working with our partners to try and see how we can make this more sustainable. How, as Archana said, if insist that every rupee must only be used to serve a direct beneficiary, where are we going to get the money to train our people? Where are we going to get the leeway to try some new approach? Because we are constantly trying to reinvent the delivery of healthcare in communities at the last mile, because that's what disability needs. Big tertiary healthcare model that's being pushed is not suitable for persons with disability because the cost of going to a tertiary hospital and back, and the number of times you have to go and come back, the loss of wages while the caregiver goes, the difficulty in transportation, all of these, and the whole host of reasons why community-based delivery of healthcare is what we need to do. So we need private money, private philanthropy, to step into the breach, because you don't have to publish your own annual report showing growing numbers. You can study and appreciate the transformative impact of the work that we do, and you can be patient, which unfortunately by law, CSR typically is unable to do. So as we look at the evolving sector, sector in terms of funding, I think there is now a greater awareness about disability, but the disability is still invisible. Okay, so people often ask me, so what do you do? Are you on this board? Are you mentoring this company? I said, no, I don't do anything. I just volunteer with this NGO. What do they do? Oh, they work in disability. Disability. Okay, is that a big problem? And I say, well, it is one of the largest invisible minorities in the country. Unfortunately, we are undercounted. The 2% is a 2011 census when there were just 7 types of disability in the census. It's 2024. The RPWD Act passed in 2016 recognizes 17 types of disabilities. Developed countries have 15% of their population estimate as persons with disability. And you can imagine what that means if you apply the same benchmark on 140 crore people. And if you add in the elderly, okay, the fastest growing demographic in India is actually the elderly. We are estimated 180 million elders over the age of 60. Over the age of 65, almost 40% of them acquire some form of disability, whether it's locomotor, speech, hearing, or even amnesia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a large population, and they are invisible. Because they are invisible and undercounted, I think it doesn't get the attention of both policymakers, funders, and private givers, because we don't see them. Where are they if they're so big? Well, they are all around us, but you can't see them because they are shut in. One of the new projects we are starting on is a campaign to try and make the disabled more visible. How do we plan to do that? We plan to do that by campaigning to increase accessibility, to remove barriers. And we're doing that by using some innovative technology, which I'll talk to you about later, Gaurav.
You know, very, very inspiring stories and very, very, insightful information and perspective on the challenges that people with disabilities face in India. And there are lots of focused policy interventions that can also take place. And it's probably we might have the right laws, but there could also be a problem of enforcement in some cases. Probably we also need to bring in a new different set of laws, rules and regulations to deal with this, what you very aptly described as the most invisible minority in a country like India. Finally, one last question to both of you. And, you know, we are approaching the 100th year of our independence, our country's independence, a significant milestone. Now, the role of philanthropy in social development becomes increasingly pivotal. In this critical decade for India, or the next 2.5 decades, if I may say so, leading up to the centenary, the country's centenary in 2047, what innovative approaches do you believe philanthropy can adopt to contribute to a more inclusive and equitable society? Specifically, how can philanthropy better invest in and advocate for disability issues to ensure that all Indians have equal opportunities and rights? Archana, first to you and then Jacob.
Thanks, Gaurav. I think, like I said earlier, the ask from our sector is high and the resources available to us are limited. I think going forward, one of the biggest needs is capacity building of organizations as well as the disability sector as a whole. One of the challenges that we faced at Jaivakil initially was the dire need for capacity building. And we found that nobody wanted to support it or was willing to invest in it, which is so unlike what you would do for companies in the corporate space, right? And this was a learning, you can call it a learning or you can call it a need that I landed up taking to the ATE Chandra Foundation. And today we have a full vertical that is dedicated to addressing this need, not just for one NGO, but I think for all the NGOs, both in the disability space as well as in the social sector as a whole. Absolutely, programs are important, but at the foundation, we understand the importance of investing not just in building, programs, but also in building organizations as well as the capacity of leaders. Today, I think ATECF is one of the largest sponsors of learning and development in the country. They support 8 programs and train over 2,500 leaders annually. And these programs are run by best-in-class partners like Dasra. And our whole theory of change through that is that inspired and well-equipped leaders are as critical to better outcomes in the social sector as the IIT and IIMs were to building corporate India in the past 3 decades. The second thing I would say is having collaborative partnerships, right? Creating platforms where government agencies, donors, and NGOs working in the space of disability can come together, collaborate, share, learn, and make better impact. I think, again, giving circles and having one on disabilities like the one Dasra has on other areas or sectors would be so fab to have. I believe partnering with the government is also very important, Gaurav, because philanthropy at the end of the day is only 2% of the social spending. 98% of the spending comes from government across areas, including disability. And as an NGO in this space, I think our job is to create proof of concepts of what works and then partner with the government to take them to scale. So, for example, in our space of intellectual disability, there's actually no board. There's no standardization of curriculum, what to teach, how to teach. And so at Jaivakil, we built a checklist on how do you assess every single child, and then how do you teach them using standardized methods of teaching, which was just layered for children like ours to learn. And all of this was funded by donors. But now we've partnered with the government to take it to scale all across Maharashtra for all schools that work with children with intellectual disability. And I think this kind of a collaborative mindset, partnership, et cetera, is really the way that you'll be able to create impact or do justice to the entire need across the country. And the third one, of course, is policy advocacy, because I think here philanthropy plays a very crucial role in helping advocate for policy changes that promote the rights and inclusion of people with disabilities. I think evolved givers can leverage their influence to help shape legislation, promote inclusive practices, and actually hold decision makers accountable for upholding the rights for these people.
Jacob?
So my advice to potential philanthropists and those considering supporting our cause is to think about us like you would with a VC investment. Spend all your time diligencing us, satisfy yourselves about our credentials and our values and ethics, and then to give us the time and the space and the resources to build out a program. It's like what somebody would say, well, take the time to get your product market fit. Social change is incredibly more complex. You go into a new community, you're dealing with the politics of the space, you're dealing with the government bureaucracy, you're dealing with religion, caste, challenges in, how remote that geography is, trying to get data, which is often very poor in India. So it takes time, and you should think about this as one of your investments, that you give time and patience and support to allow it to play out and to see those results, and to encourage well-meaning NGOs that they have the permission to try and fail. Okay, there's so much of anxiety about donors and about failure in the NGO sector that we are often timid about trying new things. As an example, I just want to share this project that we are just embarking on. It's called Yes to Access, and it says we need to give the same rights of access to public spaces, restaurants, shops, parks, wherever people, able people go. We need to give that same access to our fellow citizens who are disabled, because only then can we have a truly inclusive society. It would also make them more visible. The reason you see many more persons with disability abroad and not in India is because public spaces there are designed to be accessible. So we thought about this and we came to the conclusion that there aren't enough accessibility auditors available. The Prime Minister has announced this campaign in 2016 called the Sugamya Bharat Abhiyan or the Accessible India Campaign, but there just aren't enough accessibility auditors. So how do we solve for that? So we are working on an innovative AI-based camera, mobile phone camera-based product app that will allow a lay person to actually take pictures that would be then checked for accessibility by AI at the back end and then populated onto a map as a public good, where if you're taking your elderly mother or somebody with disability, before they go to a place, they know what barriers they're likely to face. Now, in this campaign, we have a donor, but the donor will support only the first phase. We also recognize that NGOs and the donors can't do this alone. We need civil society. And so we are hoping to crowdfund this, because until the 98% or the 85%, depending on whatever estimate you want to take about the able population, get involved in trying to make India more inclusive, that task cannot be done just by NGOs or disabled persons organization. It's going to take all of us. And that is the kind of policy and transformational work that we are hoping private philanthropy will see a way to support. And finally, on policy, as Archana said, government is the biggest change agent. Our approach is to try and leverage the extensive government system, which is in place at all levels, right down to the village. There's even a village rehabilitation worker. Unfortunately, they are not trained. So we train government disability workers. Unfortunately, they don't know what to do after that. So we help the district authorities in these rural areas with processes, with policies, with advice on how to spend government money better. We take no money from the government because it has all kinds of other challenges, but we try to make sure that government money is spent well. So there are budgets across all departments, and when they come to the end of the year, they just spend it recklessly with no idea. So as an example, a hearing aid without a person being assessed for their hearing deficiency, without it being fitted and without it being tuned, is completely useless. And we see so many hearing aids that have been just distributed by government and politicians lying unused when we do home visits. So what we do with the government is we say, okay, we'll line these people up. We will assess them. You give it. And hopefully your money and our taxpayer money goes a long way to do that.
I do believe that a society that includes all is stronger for all. Everyone deserves a seat at the table and every voice counts. It is up to us as a society to ensure that. And I'd like to end with a quote here by Mahatma Gandhi, where he says, "The greatness of a society is measured by the way it treats its weakest members."
Thank you so much, Jacob Kurian and Archana Chandra, for these very, very deep insights, and also for taking the time out to share your perspective on a variety of issues related to persons with disabilities in India, the challenges that exist, the policy interventions that are required, and what the government and the people at large need to do. Thanks for taking the time out and dropping by to have this conversation with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye, Archana.
Thanks.
Good talking to you. Bye. Lovely to hear you. Bye.